But now, how much can you find out about the workings of government now that the Freedom of Information Act is in force? Michael Crick investigates in The Right to Know.
Now, here are some things we didn't know a year ago.
How much do Britain's farmers get paid in subsidies? Today, as a result of requests under the Freedom of Information Act, we'll get much more information. And Tom Heap, our Rural Affairs...
Documents obtained by the BBC under the new Freedom of Information Act suggest that the police may not take the tough line on hunting that those who support the ban might expect.
It's been described as Black Wednesday, the day in 1992 when the Treasury went into meltdown as it tried, without success, to keep Britain in the European Exchange Rate mechanism. Now, thanks to the Freedom of Information Act, the Treasury has released some papers from the period. But, as Andrew Marr reports...
Ministers believe that despite rows about how much should be revealed, Britain's culture of secrecy is changing.
Today it's the ERM. The day before yesterday it was the Dome. The day before that it was casualty figures in relation to Iraq. There is a huge stream of information coming out that wasn't there before.
Lord Faulkner, the Secretary of State for Constitutional Affairs and the Minister in charge of FOI, Freedom of Information. So it is ERM or FOI came into force. Critics say that Britain's law on our right to know is weak compared with other countries and limited by numerous exemptions that officials can cite to excuse them from disclosing things. Few would argue that defence and security are not good reasons for keeping things secret, but public bodies can also withhold material if it might affect personal privacy or commercial confidentiality or international relations or the formulation of government policy. Richard Thomas is charged with enforcing the new FOI law in his independent role as Information Commissioner.
Generally speaking, in the first 9 months, things have gone better than expectations. There were doom and gloom merchants on both sides. Some people said, all a bit of a damp squib, too many exemptions, nothing's going to change. They were wrong. Others said, this is the end of civilisation, you know, the Sir Humphreys were feeling rather threatened, and life can't go on as normal. They were wrong too. But nor am I saying everything's perfect. It's been a very steep learning curve. There's still a long way to go before we achieve that culture change which this law is all about. We are changing the culture. We have not yet changed it.
Mr. Thomas covers England, Wales and Northern Ireland, but not Scotland, which has a similar, though slightly more open, FOI regime. Both systems cover everything in government, and FOI can be used by everyone.
One thing I think which has surprised many people is the fact that in the first 9 months it is clearly members of the public who are making the greatest use of the new law. That's really encouraging. It's not just the media, it's not just pressure groups, it's not just trade associations or trade unions. Members of the public are by far the largest single category. This is something for the country as a whole.
In this programme, I'll be examining what information you can now obtain and what's still kept secret, and exploring whether the new openness has changed the workings of government. One way to test FOI is to try it on what's long been one of the most secretive parts of the British state, the special branch of the Metropolitan Police. For decades, it's been their job to keep an eye on political subversives. But some claim they've interpreted this far too widely, monitoring mainstream campaigns as well.
The funeral commemorated the dead of Soweto. The anti-apartheid movement is calling on the government to ban all such supplies of equipment to the South African police and army. The movement say that many people...
In the 70s and 80s, the anti-apartheid movement was one of the most active protest groups in Britain, in the days when the white minority still ruled South Africa.
Several Labour MPs joined the march, which was supported by 38 organisations, including 11 trade unions.
So could we see what the special branch had collected on the AAM? I arranged to visit the Public Access Office of the Metropolitan Police in a large block near Earl's Court in West London.
Good afternoon. So what have we got here then?
Here are three files on the anti-apartheid movement that have been requested.
Thanks very much.
Well, these files are each about an inch thick, I suppose, and collections of all sorts of things. I mean, there's leaflets in here, newspaper cuttings, reports of public meetings, reports of private meetings of the anti-apartheid movement, which are clearly based on information obtained by informers or moles inside the organisation. So let's flick through and see what we've got. Here are the pretty detailed minutes being written of the annual general meeting of the anti-apartheid movement. Now these are marked secret with a red stamp, Metropolitan Police. And it says here, the meeting was uneventful apart from contributions from Peter Hain, the veteran communist Jack Waddis, and Neil Kinnock MP. And then attached to this four-page report, there's another page, an appendix, listing the vehicle registration numbers and the various cars of about six or seven of the actual people who'd attended the AGM. So they've gone to an extraordinary amount of trouble, and clearly they've got somebody in the meeting reporting back. What have we here? Information has been received that a new anti-apartheid group has been formed in Ealing. The organiser is aged 17 years, and then he gives his name and address and phone number, a schoolboy attending Northolt High School. So there are extensive references to individuals, and often next to individuals there'll be file numbers, presumably referring to references in other files relating to those individuals, and in certain cases I think probably individual files held on those individuals. Later on, we have received information from a reliable source indicating that Peter Hain proposes to stage a demonstration at this airport today against the Middlesex Rugby Football Club, who are due to depart on a tour of South Africa. What have we here? There's a letter in The Guardian in defence of Tony Benn and his views. Clearly somebody in Special Branch thought that that was worthy of note. Moving on, here's a file from 1988. And here's a Special Branch threat assessment.
What was fascinating about the archive was the sheer volume of material gathered and the degree of detail, though much of it seemed pretty innocuous. Documents range from detailed reports of large demonstrations, itemising each banner displayed and slogan chanted, down to reports of meetings of local anti-apartheid groups, some with just six or seven people present, one of whom, at least, must have been the police informer. Some items seemed absurd, such as a report that AAM posters had been found in a shed under a fire escape behind a factory in Barnet, and a telegram stating that a part-time worker with Sainsbury's in Croydon had been spotted handing out AAM leaflets to fellow members of staff. There were references to information from secret and reliable sources, and some pained accounts of sitting through lengthy diatribes of turgid rhetoric. Among individuals mentioned were people who've now become respectable government ministers, not just Peter Hain, but also Fiona McTaggart and Richard Caborn. And yet I could find no suggestion anywhere in the files that the anti-apartheid movement had ever done anything criminal. Seeing these files was certainly the most striking example I've noticed of a new openness in government. Before FOI, one would never obtain such material from this most sensitive part of the police. Superintendent David Chinchin was the project manager for implementing FOI within the Met.
You've had your experience. You've gone into Special Branch. You've looked at a file here. We've had other requests to equally sensitive, I should say, parts of the organisation. Parts of the organisation which I think the public would perceive as being quite secretive. It's not about a particular area of our business. It really doesn't matter. It's a case-by-case decision about specifically what's being asked for.
But how easy was it to get police officers to accept freedom of information?
We did see this as trying to change the culture a bit of an organisation. It wasn't simply just preparing for a right of access. We firmly want to move the organisation more to being naturally open, and a presumption that we will put information into the public domain. Once we convinced people within the organisation that really what we needed to protect could be protected under this legislation, we were far more likely then to start releasing the other material.
Patrick Lavelle of Sunderland University, who's been researching FOI and the police, says it's had a big effect on forces all over Britain.
Well, I think more information is coming out, and the police service is more accountable now than it ever has been. A few examples of stories that have appeared, particularly in the regional press, are about, you know, the number of racist police officers who are still in their jobs, the number of police officers who have been caught speeding but have kept their jobs, the number of police officers who have been suspended, chief constables' expenses, the cost of inquiries. There has been information given out about the Soham murder case, for instance, about police ineptitude during that particular inquiry.
What's the title of your research?
The actual research paper is called The Not-So-Secret Police, because from the research that I've done, it appears that the police are not as secret as they used to be. The police are more open and accountable now than they ever have been, and that's a result of FOI.
And yet the police haven't totally opened up. This summer, when they shot the Brazilian Jean-Charles de Menezes at Stockwell Station, mistaking him for a terrorist, I, along with many others no doubt, made an FOI request to see the Met's guidelines on their so-called shoot-to-kill-to-protect policy. So far, they've not even acknowledged my request. The police are only a small part of the public sector affected by FOI, which covers over 100,000 public authorities, ministries, quangos, councils, schools, hospitals, not forgetting the BBC, which, for example, has been obliged to reveal expense claims by senior executives. But with so many bodies involved, inconsistency is perhaps inevitable. We asked local councils near airports for their hygiene inspection reports on airline catering companies, documents not normally available to the public before. But are they now? Some councils, such as Hounslow and Spelthorne near Heathrow, sent them to us without any problem. Crawley, near Gatwick, asked for a £480 fee, the cost, they said, of sending us 24 reports. And Slough Council, also near Heathrow, refused outright, citing commercial confidentiality. They would only release a basic summary of their inspector's findings. Such differences come as no surprise to Maurice Frankel of the Campaign for Freedom of Information.
This is going to carry on until we get some decision notices from the Commissioner clearing these type of issues up. So I think we have to wait for that to be cleared up by the Commissioner's office. But I think the fact that we've got a good number of authorities releasing this information without causing any difficulty about it is a significant step, and I can't imagine that the outcome will be to stop the positive authorities disclosing and bring them into line with those that are refusing. I'm sure the outcome will be the other way round, to bring the refusers up to scratch with those who are disclosing.
Maurice Frankel could be right. Hillingdon Council, which covers much of Heathrow, refused at first to give us its inspection reports on in-flight catering firms. But when we told Hillingdon that other nearby councils had released theirs, they gave in and did likewise. The reports themselves do sometimes turn up problems. In January, Hillingdon inspected hygiene at Gate Gourmet, the British Airways supplier recently hit by industrial action. This found a mouldy ceiling panel, a failure to check food temperatures because a thermometer was missing, and or cake and bodies feel threatened by the FOI Act and by the Environmental Information Regulations, EIR, which came into force at the same time and require similar disclosure. Take Actis. It's a spin-off from what used to be known as the Commonwealth Development Corporation and looks after £1.5 billion from Britain's aid budget for investing in poor countries. One of its partners, Paul Owers, recently addressed a conference on FOI and said this:
"Our default position is not to disclose. If there's an exemption that we can use, or there's a close call on an exemption which we could use, we will use it. In some cases, it's about, it's about delaying disclosure rather than putting off the disclosure forever."
But what he really fears is that a range of people, aided perhaps by an inside source, could combine forces and between them seek out the facts.
It hasn't happened yet. But I think for us, the nightmare scenario is where we have a journalist who teams up with a disaffected employee and a member of parliament, and pursuant to FOIA and EIR, we get assaulted through FOIA and EIR requests together with parliamentary questions.
The environmental group Friends of the Earth put in an information request to ACTIS about a project in Papua New Guinea. Their lawyer is Phil Michaels.
The information that we requested was a simple environmental impact assessment for a project in South Asia that we and other NGOs had serious environmental concerns about. An environmental impact assessment is precisely the sort of document that should always be available to members of the public. I think it's appalling that a body that's responsible for investing such huge amounts of UK government money in developing countries has this sort of cavalier or even hostile attitude to the principles underlying the Freedom of Information Act.
ACTIS wouldn't do an interview for this programme, but told us they strive to be open and honest in all their dealings, while respecting commercial confidentiality. And recently they said they voluntarily disclosed environmental information in response to Friends of the Earth's request. What about Whitehall departments? It's hard to winkle out internal policy advice, since that can be exempt from FOI. But what about pure and simple facts of the kind, for instance, which ministers regularly trot out at parliamentary questions?
In the region of 90,000 fixed penalty notices issued, there are nearly 4,000 antisocial behaviour orders issued, there are almost 9,000 curfew orders, there are almost...
So we asked directly to see the figures in the briefing folders which ministers take into the Commons for question time. Every department refused, though some of their reasons might have made Sir Humphrey blush. The Ministry of Defence, for example, argued that
if officials knew that the statistics included in briefing folders were likely to be published, they would tend either to include many more statistics so as to camouflage those of particular interest, or to omit statistics altogether.
We also submitted several FOI requests to Downing Street. Number 10 has already disclosed the names of Tony Blair's guests at Chequers, for instance. So what about releasing his Christmas card list? No, said Number 10. And among their reasons was,
Christmas cards are not sent to all the Prime Minister's contacts, and release of the detailed list might offend those contacts who did not receive a card.
But I would have thought that people who don't get a Christmas card from the Blairs already know that, unless they kid themselves each year it's been lost in the post. We also asked for a list of elected foreign leaders to whom Mr. Blair has sent congratulation letters. The Cabinet Office turned this down because
releasing the names of the recipients and the date the message was sent could lead to unhelpful speculation as to the content of those messages.
A couple of years ago, before FOI came into force here, I got hold of letters between Tony Blair and the Swedish Prime Minister, Göran Persson. Not from Downing Street, but from the Swedish government itself, which is probably the strongest FOI tradition in the world. So, after FOI arrived here, we put in a reverse request to Number 10 for Mr. Blair's correspondence with Mr. Persson. Number 10 replied,
we are withholding this information because, in our judgment, to release it into the public domain would be likely to prejudice relations between the British and Swedish governments.
It's hard to see how that could be so, when the Swedes happily dole out copies of many such letters to anyone who asks. How does Downing Street regard FOI? Maurice Frankel again.
Downing Street is more secretive than the rest of government. I think they have difficulty reconciling themselves to the fact that freedom of information applies to them. And I think you see resistance to requests which other government departments accept as perfectly natural. I think where you have Downing Street involved, it doesn't share that shift towards more openness.
Frankel is also worried about the Department for Constitutional Affairs, the DCA, who are meant to promote FOI. He went round Whitehall, asking each department for copies of their responses to requesters' appeals against FOI decisions.
Before doing that, I asked a series of government FOI officers whether that would cause them any problems, and they all said, no, we're perfectly happy. The Department for Constitutional Affairs, however, has advised government departments not to supply that information. There's a centralised attempt to stop this, what I regard as innocuous information, being disclosed. And I think that is a worrying type of development.
Are you finding that the Department of Constitutional Affairs is acting as a restraining influence on the rest of government?
It acts in two different ways. It promotes freedom of information, and sometimes is very positive about encouraging people to comply with the spirit of the Act. And it then also takes a defensive line and says to departments, we don't want any of you to step out of line and set a precedent of disclosing this information, which will then make it more difficult for everybody else to withhold it.
We spoke privately to a top civil servant who retired this year, having worked at the highest levels of government. He told us,
within Whitehall, there was criticism of departments which were releasing too much, even though they felt they were only doing it because they would be forced to eventually by the Commissioner. We as a department were told by the DCA not to release things, as it would let the side down. So there were our friends in the DCA pretending to be the most open, when really they weren't.
Lord Falconer, Secretary of State at the DCA.
Other departments seek advice from us as to what the right approach in relation to FOI is. That will involve, from time to time, giving advice on whether or not a particular exemption applies, whether or not on the balance of the public interest tests there should be disclosure or not disclosure. It's perfectly normal and indeed sensible that what we should be trying to do is identify a cross-government approach. It is perfectly sensible that there be somewhere in the centre of government that gives advice in relation to that.
So, in the 9 months so far, what impact has FOI had on how governments run? The retired Mandarin we spoke to told us,
we've become less frank on paper. There was the beginnings of a post-it note culture, stuff that gets stuck on which is thrown away later. And people now write documents saying at the top, this is a policy submission to ministers, this is not a factual document, even when it's not really true.
And of course, policy submissions to ministers can officially be exempt under the Act. So how has FOI itself affected government business? Ed Owen was special advisor to the Foreign Secretary Jack Straw until the general election.
I think one of the biggest implications, certainly when I was in government for those first 3 months of the after the implementation of the Act earlier this year, was a much more cautious, if I can say, view of sending emails to other officials. And certainly, I suspect, the number of emails sent across Whitehall has reduced significantly since January the 1st. That's not to say that FOI is a bad thing. I think there have been some positive aspects to it. But the downside of this is that it will make officials more cautious in what they put down on paper or on email.
You actually saw that happening then?
Yeah. Certainly for me, personally speaking, I was more cautious in what I put down on email as a result of understanding the implications of the Act.
Presumably it's not just email we're talking about here, but other reports and memos and so on.
Yeah, sure.
Dennis McShane, a former journalist, also experienced FOI in practice as a minister until this May, again in the Foreign Office.
I have had phone calls in which people have said, can we discuss this minister rather than put it on paper? And I think there'll be a lot more now discussion time rather than people being forced to be shorter and to the point on paper. I've certainly had senior ambassadors, people whose dispatches I read with care as Europe Minister, saying to me, well, if the frank advice I've been used to be having given is now going to pop up in a tabloid just in a scandalous story, I won't give it. And I think now a lot of this information is going to go offshore. It will be exchanged, but maybe in a telephone call, in a face-to-face meeting. It won't be there circulated to hundreds of other decision-makers, and I think the quality of decision-making may suffer as a result.
So have you changed your mind then?
No, I can't, because I think freedom of information has to be a good thing. And if you like, I mean, I'm now split down the middle. I'm in a quandary. I'm a journalist. I was president of the National Union of Journalists. It's been a campaigning issue all my adult life. I'm just not convinced we've quite got it right.
But Lord Falconer says that's not his experience.
I haven't noticed that. Speaking entirely for myself, it hasn't changed at all the way I write things down, or what I write down, or who I write them down to, or what I say in emails. I have not noticed at all there being a different sort of flow of paper towards me as a minister. I have not had any experience of people saying to me, I'm ringing you up to tell you this rather than write it down because of freedom of information.
Phil Michaels of Friends of the Earth thinks any harm is only a short-term problem.
We've seen from the overseas experience that that isn't the case in the long term. And in fact, What may happen is you get rather better systems of minute-taking and documentary recording and better filing systems so that members of the public are able to access the information more efficiently in the long term. And the idea that in the future government is going to operate on a sort of telephone, non-paper recorded basis just simply doesn't add up. It's not possible for an organisation as big as government to operate in that way.
In Scotland, there's been an even higher rate of FOI requests than in the rest of the United Kingdom. And the Scottish king of FOI is surely Paul Hutchin, political editor of the Sunday Herald. An FOI response this May showed that by then he'd made around 400 requests to the Scottish Executive, a staggering 42% of all the requests they'd received. And he's kept up his frenetic use of the new law on behalf of his paper, bombarding the staff of Scottish quangos and councils too, with incessant demands for information.
Yes, I think I'm one of the more unpopular journalists, because I do seem to be giving them a lot of work.
Have they expressed their irritation to you, some of the press officers and other officials that you've dealt with?
Oh, yes. Occasionally, when you fire over a batch of, say, 60 questions, maybe a press officer will give you a call and say that, would you be able to refine these questions? Of course, I think what they're saying is, could you refine the questions in such a way that you don't give us so much work? I don't fall for that.
In Scotland, the law is a bit different, and Hutchin has experience of how it works on both sides of the border.
Certainly, the Scottish system is more liberal. The rules are tighter south of the border, so it gives public bodies in England and Wales more scope to withhold information. You really have to make a strong case in Scotland to say that disclosure would cause substantial prejudice to the workings of government.
And have you noticed a difference in the amount that you've been getting from Scottish institutions compared with UK institutions?
Absolutely. I will ask Scottish public bodies for memos and letters and emails. Generally, I will get that information. But if I was to ask the same question of departments in Whitehall, more often than not, I'll not get anything.
Quite apart from Mr. Hutchin's persistence, use of the new law in Scotland may also have been boosted by a major advertising campaign by the Scottish Information Commissioner. And Scottish local councils have been flooded with requests. Craig Geddes, the records manager for East Renfrewshire, has had more than 200, not just from the media, but business, politicians, campaign groups, charities and the public, ranging from details on drugs in schools to the number of cooling towers in his district. It's all getting a bit much.
What's causing some difficulties is the volume of inquiry that we're receiving and having to deal with, and some of the nature of some of the inquiries themselves has caused problems. I think some people are feeling, with good reason, that while we're happy to deal with FOI, we accept that's part of the landscape now, there is also some resentment that the work that we're there to do isn't getting done.
What sort of work's not getting done then?
Well, I think if you've got an environmental health officer having to deal with an FOI inquiry, which may take hours or even days' work, or if you've got social work support staff doing the same thing, education support staff, they all have jobs to do. Local authorities, of course, have very limited resources. And as I said, while I wouldn't want for a minute to give the impression that we don't welcome FOI and are committed to it, nonetheless, there are times where tight time is having to be spent on dealing with these inquiries rather than developing the core work.
And councils don't get extra funds to cope with their FOI activity, though some of the heavy demand may be due to the novelty of the new regime. Maurice Frankel.
You first of all have to wait until the system learns how to deal with requests. I think what you see in the first 6 or 8 months is likely to be much more labour intensive than it will be when people become used to handling these decisions in the first place.
Heather Brooke, a journalist who has used FOI laws in America, is the author of Your Right to Know, a guide on how to use our new system here.
People think, is it a waste of taxpayers' money? Totally not. It is the most efficient way to clean up government, to make it more professional, more streamlined. You know, in the long run, you're not wasting money, you're not repeating the same mistakes over and over again just because nobody's seen them. In the end, it does save money and it does create better public services, much more so than having thousands of regulators that everyone has to send off different performance targets to.
Our FOI junkie, the journalist Paul Hutchin, spends hours each week launching new requests, chasing progress on old ones and lodging appeals when he's been rebuffed. But it's worth it, he says. The responses have given the Sunday Herald a steady stream of stories.
Because I work on a Sunday paper, I'll maybe get an average of one, two FOI stories a fortnight. I've had good stories on cultural policy and immigration policy. You tend to get secret reports from councils, which you wouldn't have got before FOI.
What sort of subjects?
Well, I mean, I had one recently on the National Theatre of Scotland, which is going to be moving to Easter House in Glasgow at the end of the year. I managed to get a secret report which showed that the building was going to be too small. Now, I don't think I would have got that simply by asking the press office.
When this list came out of all the number of requests all these journalists had made, what was people's reaction to that?
I think that the list was probably produced to embarrass me. I certainly got teased.
By whom?
By fellow journalists. I don't want to be known as an FOI nerd.
I think you've had it. I think you probably are going to be for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I don't think there's much I could do about that. But, you know, I'm not doing anything illegal. The Act is there for journalists. It's no use just accepting what a press office says. You really have to get to the bottom of a story, and I think that FOI is one way of doing that.
The overall picture is that in practice so far, freedom of information has been patchy. Friends of the Earth have put in around 100 requests over the last 9 months. Phil Michaels.
It's been a really mixed bag. We have got information out that previously we certainly wouldn't have got from public authorities, and that's got to be a good thing. On the other hand, we are not getting as much information as I think the legislation entitles us to get, and we're certainly not getting the information as quickly as the legislation requires us to get it.
And delay has possibly been the biggest problem. Legally, public bodies generally have to respond to requests within 20 working days. In reality, it often takes much longer. Lord Faulkner acknowledges the difficulty.
I would hope as the months go on, as people become much more used in public authorities to freedom of information being the order of the day, that the delays will get less. If, for the first time, there is a legal regime which determines whether you give information or not, which there's never been before, then quite understandably, bits of government, local authorities, police, health authorities have found it, to start with at least, quite difficult to adapt to that, which I quite understand, which I think explains what I think are unacceptable delays in some cases, and I'm quite sure you can cite lots of examples where the delays have been too long.
Well, let me cite an example from your own department, the Department for Constitutional Affairs.
Yeah.
We wrote an email on the 1st of April requesting the minutes of the Whitehall Practitioners Group on Freedom of Information, a group of officials. And we got a reply on the 20th of June saying that, unfortunately, they'd lost the email initially because of a technical problem.
I apologise for that, Mike.
And then, on the 11th of July, we got a letter saying, we plan to let you have a response by the 26th of July.
Yeah.
On the 27th of July, we got another letter, very similar, saying, we plan to let you have a response by the 9th of August.
Yeah.
On the 7th of September, got another letter saying, we plan to let you have a response by the 21st of September. And, wait for it, on the 21st of September, we got a letter saying we hope to respond by the 12th of October.
Well, I'm
going
sure
to get a response, do
no,
you think?
I'm really sorry about that, Michael, but I'm quite sure that you'll be able to find examples like that. My department has both had a lot of requests to the department and is also the clearinghouse advising other departments in Whitehall as well. We've obviously got to try and prioritise the requests, and we have dealt with literally thousands of requests during the course of this year and given up lots of information in relation to those thousands of requests. I deeply apologise that the Whitehall FOI Practitioners Group minutes has not yet got to the top of the pile. It should have done, and we've gone over the limit.
For the seasoned FOI campaigner Maurice Frankel, these problems threaten to discredit the whole system.
What I'm most concerned about are the delays that we're seeing, both from central government, or some parts of central government, and I think latterly in the Information Commissioner's office. And so I think in some areas the system is sort of slowing down to a very, very slow progress, and you can see people becoming disillusioned
with it as they wait for an answer.
The Information Commissioner Richard Thomas, who has the job of adjudicating appeals, already has a huge backlog of cases, mounting week by week. He was expected to develop a body of precedent on what should be released and what needn't be, but so far he's reached few significant verdicts, hence the growing impatience. Richard Thomas.
I recognise that. We have to look into these cases very carefully. We've had about 1,600 complaints ourselves in the first 8 months of the year. More and more substantive cases where we're looking at the application of exemptions are coming forward now. We've got a lot of work on. We'd like to speed up. We are looking to get cases through as quickly as possible.
FOI campaigner Heather Brooke is disappointed in the Commissioner so far, having held high hopes he would strike early blows for freedom of information.
He made a lot of statements saying he was going to make examples of a few people early on. I thought he would make some bold rulings. I thought he would be very interested in asserting his independence from government, and so far he hasn't done that.
We won't really know the impact of FOI until Mr. Thomas starts to issue important rulings. For the moment, we'll have to make do with his statement of principle, which certainly seems clear and radical.
Freedom of information is really all about trust in government. It's reminding us that government exists, if you like, for the people. It's spending our money. The public are the ultimate custodians of power. Information is power. That's what I see as 21st century democracy. It's a good thing to tell the public what you're doing. That will reinforce trust in your own organisation.
The Right to Know was presented by Michael Crick and produced by Martin Rosenbaum.